Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We have a fascinating program today, and we're going to get to it as soon as I ask you, our listeners, to consider a very special request, and that is to contact us. We'd love to hear from you in regard to program ideas, you know, topics, things we can look up for you, try to get some guests that might be able to fill in the blanks of areas of interest that you might have. What I'd like to do is to have you either write us a traditional letter through the mail or email us. I'd like to first give you our mailing address. So if you want to put a stamp on a letter, you would send it to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. And the zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you prefer emailing us, please do so at this address, clemens10@aol.com. That's C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10@aol.com. While you're on the computer, I'd like to encourage you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. You would find that at spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. Well, again, I hope that we hear from you. But right now, we are delighted to be able to hear from our special guest today. First, let me inform you that Dorothy Riera, my co-host, was unable to be with us today. So I'm going solo with my guest, and I'm delighted to welcome the director of the Center for Faith and Public Life at Fairfield University, Ms. Melissa Kwan. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here with you. We want to talk about this Center for Faith and Public Life. Now, those who are longtime listeners of our program might recall that Father Richard Ruscavage was the director for many, many years and has been a frequent guest here on Thoughts for the Week. But we're delighted to welcome Melissa. Melissa, when did you take over?
Well, I took over this past summer, so August, I guess, to be exact.
Were you involved with the center before?
Yes, I've been working with the center since its inception in 2006. So I worked with Father Rick for quite a long time. Ah. Yeah, since his the founding of the center.
Now, for those who may not be too aware of the center and what it does, maybe I could ask you a little bit about the function of the center, what its mission might be.
Sure. So the center was founded in 2006, and the primary purpose was to integrate the Jesuit Catholic mission through the academic work of the university. Mm-hmm. So I think about our work in three different ways, teaching. So we have a couple of programs that really focus on experiential learning. Service learning is one of the programs where we work with faculty to integrate community service as an experiential learning tool. Mm-hmm. So that students are putting into practice what they're learning in the classroom through work with various community, faith, and school organizations. We have a humanitarian action minor. We're really trying to help prepare students for either, professions in the field of humanitarian action response or how to just be educated, involved citizens around humanitarian action response. So those are our two big teaching initiatives. Research has been another big area of the center. We've done a couple of bigger research projects focused on the issue of migration, coming at it through the lens of Catholic social teaching and, Jesuit mission and tradition. And then third area is just creating a public forum for, discussion on issues where faith intersects with civic life.
Well, that's quite a work, and that's terrific.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just wondering, how do students become involved with the center in particular?
Yeah, it's different ways. With service learning, they're enrolling in courses. It's part of their coursework. So they may or may not know that they're enrolling in a course that is a service learning course. We certainly, make an effort to help students understand and seek out those courses. So that's one way, through course involvement. With the Juhan courses, they're making a bit more of an intentional decision to, seek out the minor in humanitarian action studies. So course enrollment would be one way, but then we also have a lot of students who are just seeking out our programs. We offer a number of programs that are not, course related. We have, for example, every fall we take students to the United Nations for an immersive experience. Every spring we do a spring break trip to Washington, D.C. to really just get an understanding of the different ways of being involved in public life. And more recently, we've been offering students the opportunity to participate in simulation experiences. So these are offered in different locations throughout the United States. But in each case, there's a humanitarian crisis that's being simulated, and students are assigned a role, and they have an opportunity to really kind of immerse themselves in that experience and try to play out the role that they're given. So lots of experiential education.
Now, with this, this isn't like a Peace Corps experience, is it, where they actually go to vocations and work with people, but rather they get almost an academic but experiential sense of what these crises or humanitarian needs might be?
Right, for the simulation experiences, yes, and they're short term. So this is just, you know, a 3 or 4 day experience, just to kind of give them a taste of the complexity of what's going on in a humanitarian crisis, from, you know, the triage moment, you know, to moving on to longer term solutions.
Now, when we look at this, it's obviously a fascinating topic, how to bring faith into public life, and where the church, the teachings of Christ, the church's activity, and the Jesuit mission kind of blends into responding to the needs of people.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering is, how do you see where faith and this public life intersect? Now, obviously, you mentioned a number of things, humanitarian needs. Do you? I guess I'm asking in terms of perhaps the lives of the students and their interest, and what kind of generates that interest in them, and how you see, but of course I see a tremendous intersection of faith and public life, but where you might see it in respect to your center.
Sure. You know, I think it's hard to imagine where faith and public life don't intersect. You know, as people of faith, regardless of our tradition, you know, we bring that lens to the way that we engage in the world. You know, in the work that we do, you know, we really look to Catholic social teaching as a lens to kind of unpack some of the experiences or injustices that students are witnessing or experiencing through their work. So, you know, take, for example, just the, you know, the idea of upholding human dignity, you know. So, you know, how do you uphold the human dignity of each person when we're talking about, you know, immigration reform or education reform or healthcare reform? So to really try to look at it through that lens. You know, maybe I'll share a specific example. We had a grant recently to do some work with parishes on Long Island where immigration was a really divisive issue. And we held two different kind of town hall meetings with a number of different parishes. In the first town hall meeting, we framed the discussion about immigration through, you know, the lens of economics, law, you know, economy. And then the second conversation, we framed it through the lens of faith. And because we were working with Catholic parishes, through the Catholic faith, you know, how do we understand immigration, or where does immigration appear in our Catholic tradition? And we looked at how that changed the conversation. It was a pretty dramatic difference in the way that people talked about immigration and immigrants, you know, moving from, you know, speaking about them from a legal perspective to speaking about them as their neighbor. So those are the different ways that we just try to approach it, using it as a critical lens.
Do you see that need to, well, I use terms like put a human face on an issue, but just what you're saying, you know, if you're going to talk about human dignity, you wonder how that's even defined today in a secular approach versus that of a faith approach. Do you find in your own experience some confusion over what very high sounding and great words such as dignity and worth and being a neighbor and human rights, even, you know, all of these things depend on a certain foundation. And I'm just wondering if, of course, dealing with parishes, perhaps not as much, but any confusion in people's minds as to just how do you proceed with understanding what dignity is today.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know if I would describe it as confusion, as just it's complex. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that, you know, through, you know, experience and direct experience and direct engagement is a really effective tool for understanding those complexities and to really try to, you know, come to a more sophisticated understanding, you know, of human dignity. We I think, throw terms around like solidarity and social mm-hmm. justice, but to really engage directly with it, I think, is where you develop that more sophisticated mm-hmm. understanding. And I think it helps to cut through the polarized discourse, you know, when mm-hmm. you are speaking about immigration, you know, based on your experience working with individuals or hearing the stories of people's lives. So I think that's mm-hmm. what drives me in the work and where we find our inspiration to do the work that we do in the center.
When we think about immigration, I mean, all of us, well, certainly those who are perhaps my age, we've had parents or grandparents who emigrated to this country from mm-hmm. various points, wherever it may be. Mm-hmm. And so you've identified with that idea of coming from somewhere else and that the part of your family and how it's how their presence in this country affected what they wanted for you, mm-hmm. and what type of atmosphere and environment you wanted to see.
Right.
This takes on various struggles as well as sometimes some easier aspects of that. But regard to immigration, we take a look at, I think, the importance of communities.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that that you have that a sense of those immigrants who are coming over into this country, that they migrate, if you use that term, to communities where members of the country that they came from are there and established and perhaps making a successful life?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you find that they, the greater concern, maybe from the point of view of the center, might be for those who are having a tremendous amount of difficulty
mm-hmm.
Fitting in.
Mm-hmm. I guess it would be a little bit of both. I mean, the context that I'm most familiar with is the Bridgeport community, and it mm-hmm. seems to be that, you know, it's both and. Mm-hmm. You know, that there are, you know, well-established immigrant communities in Bridgeport that might then be a draw. But, you know, we also see a great deal of refugees being resettled, you know, through the International Institute of Connecticut, and that's a very different, you know, situation. So I think it's both and.
Mm. Okay, because, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Bridgeport, because that's where I was born. My family and ended up in Bridgeport along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think of all the parishes that were national parishes,
mm-hmm.
and there still are many down there.
Mm-hmm.
You just found that idea of community would be very much there. But the point of view of the refugee,
mm-hmm.
now they may or may not have some ties to let's say, a community like in the city of Bridgeport or
mm-hmm.
somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
If not, who gets involved there? Let's say they're coming over and not sure, you know, they're basically resettling refugees. I presume the government, of course, is involved with establishing their presence in the country
mm-hmm.
and residence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get involved in that at all, or is that something that you tend more to just study how that works?
You know, our direct involvement through that has been through mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been a growing component of the International Institute of Connecticut's work is, you know, identifying mentors for every refugee that they're helping to resettle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they be, you know, 2 years old or 60 years old, they're trying to find, you know, one-on-one mentor opportunities to help families navigate and, you know, integrate into the community. So for the past, I guess it's been about a year and a half now, we've been operating a mentoring program on our campus for refugee youth. So on a weekly basis, we bring 20 to 25 refugee youth to campus, and we do a range of activities from them. Some of it's academic, you know, helping them finish their homework, and some of it is just, you know, recreational, playing soccer, talking, sharing about their culture, you know, dancing. Music seems to be a space of common ground for the college students and the refugee youth. So that's been one of our areas of direct engagement.
Would you, now Father Ruskovich is down in Washington, is he doing anything in particular that is different, let's say, from his involvement with the United Nations? Do you know much about what his activity is there?
I don't know much about what he's doing outside of teaching. So he is at Georgetown, working in the School of Foreign Service, teaching some courses on migration and refugee issues. So, yeah, that's the extent of what I know. I'm not sure what he's doing outside of the university work.
Now, with his involvement with the United Nations, does the center still engage with the United Nations very much today?
We do our immersive experience there for students, and we've been participating in, I think every fall they have a World Youth Day, and so we've sent a delegation of youth down that, and more recently for Women's Day, they have a special event that we've had students able to participate in.
What, let's say, the most popular types of programs for the students at this point?
Well, I think, you know, through service learning, through the courses, we, you know, we engage with over 800 students per year. And I think the Juhan program, that's how we refer to the Humanitarian Action. It actually stands for Jesuit University's Humanitarian Action Network. It's a real draw for students. They're very interested in humanitarian issues and trying to figure out how to not only become involved, but how to be effective. So, you know, when you think about everything from, you know, what to do when a tornado runs through, to what to do, you know, when people are displaced by war. How can you really be effective? They're very interested in that.
You know, which is no surprise to me that, that they would be, especially at that age. But when you mention the word effective, that to me may, I'm just wondering if that has even more of a concern. As I was growing up, the news, what I learned about what was going on in the world, was less available, local news much more available, and you're concerned about, you know, people struggling, or you're concerned about the poor people out in some other country or in some other continent. But it wasn't, let's say, as continuous or as part of the almost the passing of seasons. There's always a constant concern over what's going on here and what's going on there, and you're seeing everything up close, and that notion of effectivity. So, well, my gosh, we've been dealing with these situations, you know, for thousands of years. What is it that how does it become effective? And so I'm wondering, how do you feel that maybe the students are saying, oh yeah, maybe this will work, you know, or maybe this will be something that truly is efficacious?
Yeah. It's a hard question to answer. You know, I think minimally, we want students to be able to think about what they're doing. You know, the Juhan program actually evolved after Hurricane Katrina, when a couple of Jesuit campuses came together and said, you know, if we work together, if we were a little bit more thoughtful and strategic, we might be able to have a better impact, or at least help students think when, you know, they're running to buy a case of water bottles and donate it. You know, what does that mean? What does that do? We want them to think about, you know, the communities, and really trying to think from the perspective of the community. You know, what does the community need, you know, in this moment, rather than kind of being so distant from it? So I guess that's one thing. I think the other is, being honest with them. You know, we have had a number of different professionals from the field of humanitarian action and response, you know, speak with the students, and they're very honest about the complexities and some of what you touched on, the ineffectiveness of some of what's going on right now.
You know, when as you were speaking, I was thinking about an experience I had with a young, now middle-aged, a man that I know from New Hampshire, who was part of the New Hampshire National Guard. And you mentioned Katrina, and they were part of the group that went down to New Orleans to work on that, in regard to that. And he talked a lot about the passing out of water bottles.
Yeah.
And I just think about, you know, effectiveness.
Yeah.
You know, and you just wish the students recognize that, yeah, it did help.
Yeah.
It did go down.
Yeah.
It was part of really dealing with either saving or giving comfort to people.
Right.
In great stress.
Sure.
You know, but I wonder, do you interact much with the state of Connecticut?
You know, we don't do much, on the state level.
Mm-hmm.
We don't.
Mm-hmm. So, but that I presume that might be more of a more hands-on type of thing, and you wouldn't be as involved with that as the learning process with it. But then again, maybe there'd be possibilities there.
Yeah.
What happens on the local level? You would think that students not only would be able to get a sense of, well, here are programs, but here are programs in action.
Mm-hmm.
And do they immerse themselves in that type of activity? Or
yes, I'd say, you know, a majority of our engagement is at the local level. So we do a lot of work within the community of Bridgeport. You know, a couple of organizations that we work with. We've been working with Seiza Bataya Elementary School, which is a pre-K through 8 elementary school in Bridgeport, one of the largest in the states, specializes in bilingual education. And, you know, we've been in a partnership with them for about 5 years now. And, you know, we have anywhere from 50 to 100 students working there on an annual, a weekly basis throughout the academic year. Everything from, you know, tutoring middle school students to working within the classrooms of younger grades, kindergarten, first and second, focused on literacy. So so that's a real significant partnership that we have and that we've been collaborating with our Graduate School of Education and Allied Professions to work with. We do a lot of work with the International Institute of Connecticut, which I mentioned earlier, several of the Head Start sites throughout the Bridgeport community. So we do, you know, engage quite a bit locally.
What basic needs from the point of view of immigration do you find, let's say, in that school setting? Are you dealing more with coming from Spanish-speaking countries, coming from more now from Arabic-speaking countries, or where are they coming from?
Well, at, you know, Seiza Bataya in particular, I think it's mostly from Spanish-speaking countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at each grade level, they have two classrooms dedicated to bilingual education. And I believe that's certainly the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so language, you know, we work with students a lot around language, you know, learning English, but then also so that they can learn.
Sure.
You know, literacy is required to do well in math. You know, it all intersects together. So we also work with an organization in Stanford called Building One Community. And, you know, they work with immigrants. And one of our primary areas of engagement with them is also around language, you know, just helping, giving people conversation partners.
Well, of course, there is, especially if they're coming from Spanish-speaking countries, they're in a good part of the country to begin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they're well. Luckily, they're going to find an awful lot of people who are interested in that, and especially, I guess, in the day age in which we live, where bilingualism, at least, is something that's a real benefit, versus, let's say, my immigrants coming from Italy, you have to learn English. And there was less of a awareness, except for the food, of course, let's say, a lot of Italian culture or Italian history or you know, that type of reality. So I guess they come in with also, I guess once they are able to resolve just survival questions, the sense of saying, well, maintaining my culture is good too.
Mm-hmm,
and,
absolutely.
Well, you know, in the last few minutes of the program, I don't know if you've done or have solid ideas regarding immigration reform. I mean, obviously, we've talked about that with Father Raskavage many times. But you see situations, especially, obviously, to talk about immigration on the border of with Mexico and other places where immigration becomes an issue. You see documentaries of the terrible drug trafficking and the terrible gangs coming out back and forth over the border. That you see that image, mm-hmm. and then you see the image of the poor who want it. Mm-hmm. Who want something better mm-hmm. for their country, for their people?
Mm-hmm.
It's a incredibly complex issue, mm-hmm. I presume.
Mm-hmm.
But is there any sort of things you'd like to see happen there with reform?
Yes. The work that we have done and the work that I'm closest to has been with undocumented youth.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly impacts our campus most directly.
Mm-hmm.
The Jesuit presidents have been vocal on this issue and really pushing for President and Congress to continue the deferred action for childhood arrival status mm-hmm. for young people. And so that's certainly something that I would want to see, as well as a real pathway to citizenship for young people who this country is all that they know.
Mm-hmm.
They may have come here as infants, and this is their home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, coming from the Jesuit Catholic perspective, we're also thinking about, family unity. How do we keep families
mm-hmm.
together?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not enough to say that, we want to support a pathway to citizenship for the youth, but for their families as well. Because, I resonate most closely with the story of the folks that are traveling here because they want a better life. It's a matter of survival.
Mm-hmm. And that is something where I do hope that they, and I tend to think that no matter what type of rhetoric or is exhibited down in Washington, that they will certainly want to work with those who are accomplishing
mm-hmm.
students who are here, or those who have come here, like you said, as infants. And
mm-hmm.
and this is the country they know.
Mm-hmm.
They probably say, deport me where?
Mm-hmm.
This is where I grew up, and this is where I identify my life. But let's hope that little by little things are developing there. I'm wondering is how our listeners might be able to learn a little bit more about the center.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll ask you what contact possibilities are there.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, our website is a great way to learn about the center. So that's just www.fairfield.edu/CFPL. That's for Center for Faith and Public Life. Also, anyone can call at any time, call the main number and ask for Melissa Kwan, and I'd be happy to talk with anyone, invite someone to visit campus to learn more about the center.
Do you need more volunteers and things, or what is that? Let's say some people might say, I'd like to do something, but I don't know what to do. Or is it? Again, you're part of the university, so it's probably...
Sure. I mean, volunteers, we don't really coordinate mm-hmm. volunteer opportunities for folks off campus. We really focus mm-hmm. on as part of our student learning and formation. But I think there are other ways to support, just getting the word out about the center, certainly contributing to the center financially mm-hmm. to make student opportunities, students able to participate in all the opportunities that we have to offer.
Terrific. Well, we've been speaking with Melissa Kwan, who is the director of the Center for Faith and Public Life at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. I hope you go online and learn a little bit more about it. Melissa, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Our listeners, thank you. Please join us again.